The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
I'm Josh Hammer. Welcome back. We're thrilled to be joined this week later in the program by Dinesh D'Souza. He is the acclaimed author, filmmaker, and director of the brand new film, 2000 Mules, which I had the privilege of seeing just last week, so could not be more timely. But speaking of timely, I do want to follow up from our episode last week with respect to the unprecedented leak of the Dobbs abortion case at the U.S. Supreme Court and all the subsequent fallout from that. So since we recorded that episode over the past 3, 4, 5, 6 days or so, the addresses of the Supreme Court justices in the majority, in the 5-justice Sam Alito penned majority opinion, and I believe the address of Chief Justice John Roberts, who, as in so many other cases, is the swing vote here, have been doxed. And we have seen left-wing activists show up to the homes of these Supreme Court justices with signs, with megaphones, with chalk painting coat hangers on the sidewalk. It has gotten so bad that there was a report Sunday evening that Justice Alito, the courageous conservative who wrote the leaked Dobbs majority opinion that would overturn Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. It's gotten so bad that a report is out that Justice Alito and his family have been moved to an undisclosed location to protect his family and preserve their safety. This is disgusting. This is absolutely disgusting. It is mad and it is insane. Joe Biden purports to somehow, a little bit, quasi-condemn it. Jen Psaki had a statement out that he strongly believes in the constitutional right to protest, but XYZ. Well, you know what? There happens to be a law against this. 18 U.S. Code Section 1507. Quote, whoever with the intent of interfering with, obstructing, or impeding the administration of justice, or with the intent of influencing any judge, juror, witness, or court officer in the discharge of his duty, pickets or parades in or near a building housing a court of the United States, or in or near a building or residence occupied or used by such a judge, blah, blah, blah. This is a federal crime. Where are the prosecutions? If the executive branch under President Joe Biden is not willing to enforce black letter law to protect the safety of the families of a coordinate branch of the Constitution, then what the hell is the Department of Justice good for? What does this DOJ stand for under President Biden if, under Attorney General Merrick Garland, it is calling parents upset about critical race theory domestic terrorists, as we saw last October, while simultaneously declining to enforce a law to prohibit potentially life-threatening injuries to Supreme Court justices? I mean, I am just galled. I am just absolutely appalled by this. There still has not been a single Democratic politician who has condemned the leak, but we've now gotten even worse than that. Not only has no one even condemned the leak, they are actively refusing to prosecute clear black letter legal violations. And the effect, obviously, is to incentivize the hard left and the next time around to just double down and double down again. We're even seeing this now outside of Washington, D.C. In Wisconsin, a pro-life group in Madison, Wisconsin, burned. It burned down after people spray painted on the pro-life group's office, if abortion is not safe, then you aren't either. I heard reports that they might have found a Molotov cocktail there. I think they're investigating it for arson as I record this. This is mobocracy. This is not a constitutional republic. This is not democracy. This is exactly the kind of thing that Abraham Lincoln saw coming, as he saw so much else coming, in his 1838 Lyceum address. He said, quote, "There is no grievance that is a fit object of redress by mob law. There is no grievance that is a fit object of redress by mob law." Mob law, put another way, is never the answer. Because as John Adams said, going back to the Massachusetts Constitution in the 1780s, we are fundamentally a government of laws and not of men. But let's take it to a quick break. On the other side, we are going to be joined by Dinesh D'Souza, who is the director of the brand new film, 2000 Mules. Stay with us. I'm just so thrilled this week to be joined, given the timeliness, by author, filmmaker, and director of the brand new documentary 2000 Mules. That's Dinesh D'Souza. So Dinesh, thank you so much for joining the Josh Hammer Show this week.
My pleasure. Great to be with you, and thanks for having me on.
Of course. So I had the personal privilege, literally last week actually, of being for the premiere of this new film at Mar-a-Lago. It was a wonderful experience. I'm grateful to you for the invite, of course. So, you know, for the listeners out there who are not familiar, why don't we just start by kind of just briefly describing what this film is?
Yeah, the film is about, it's about election fraud, but I almost hesitate to say that because we've heard so much about election fraud really since November of 2020. And I think a good way to approach this film is to sort of forget everything that you know or think you know about the subject, because you're not going to be hearing here about why they stopped the count or anomalies or how come Trump won the bellwether counties but didn't win the election. There's been a lot of election fraud talk, but it's fallen short of trying to examine the simple question: was there systematic and coordinated fraud in the 2020 election of a magnitude large enough to tip the balance? In other words, to influence and shape the outcome. The movie examines that question and does it in a completely fresh way.
So tell me about how you got interested in this topic, because this kind of, you know, you and I both work in the conservative media space. This kind of is a third rail of sorts, right? It's interesting to see someone of your immense skills and talents kind of just glom onto this issue. So what specifically, I'm kind of curious, got you so focused like a laser beam on this?
Well, I was in a sense dragged into it. And I say dragged, I mean dragged in a sense against my own skepticism, because if you know, listen to my podcast, and I have said not a word about election fraud in over a year. And part of the reason for that is I was really disappointed in the dogmatism of both sides in the debate. From the left, they would say, I kept hearing, it's the most secure election in history. Now, first of all, I've never seen anyone ever back up that statement, because if you were to say to someone on the left, well, how do you know that? They would say things like, well, sure, prove to me that there was coordinated fraud. And my point is, let's say I cannot prove it to you. Does that automatically make it the most secure election in history? How do we know it was more secure than 2016, 2012, 2008, 2004? Who's ever done a comparison of all those elections, estimating the volume of fraud and showing that 2020 had the least? I've never even seen this attempted. Nevertheless, a huge regime of censorship backs up this dogmatic claim, again, never proven. And on the other side, on the conservative side, a lot of suspicions, I smell a rat, I kind of know something went wrong. But then when you press that person and say, well, show me, can you put your finger on the fraud? They point to, I would call it episodic instead of systematic fraud. A dead guy votes over here. What happened to that, you know, batch of ballots in Fulton County? So all of this is interesting, but not decisive. And a skeptic could shoot it down very easily. And so for these reasons, I thought, you know what? The simple truth of it is we might never know what really happened in the 2020 election. This is before I sat down, my wife, Debbie, and I, with Catherine Engelbrecht and Greg Phillips of True the Vote. And we began to explore this topic in a different way. It turns out that there is a way to find out what really happened, but it's looking in a little different place and using different techniques than have been used before. So in the movie, we focus on two. One is cell phone geo-tracking, which has now become an extremely precise and reliable science. It's used in the intelligence community. It's used by law enforcement every day. You know, when you go into a mall, you get a notification that there's a special going on in the store. They know not only that you're outside the store, they can even tell which aisle you're in. So geo-tracking is that precise. So there's geo-tracking evidence, and then there's video evidence. And so when I saw that, I realized that I'm looking at evidence of a completely different caliber than I've seen before. And frankly, as a video guy, as a movie guy, I was delighted with the video evidence because I realized how cinematic it is and how well it would play in a movie.
So, I mean, that really was kind of my biggest personal takeaway from the film, was how jarring the footage is. And you guys had, I think it was, if I remember the stat, it was 4 million minutes of footage. Is that right?
Yeah, it's actually a very tiny portion of the footage we should have, because the simple truth is the election rules call for everyone to have surveillance video. I mean, every parking lot has surveillance video. The technology is available, it's very cheap, and yet most places, in all honesty, didn't do it. And so we have video, and I say we, I want to acknowledge True the Vote. They did the heavy lifting, the research on this. They made the public information request. We have a lot of video from Georgia, some from the election, some from the runoffs. We have video from Arizona, some video from Michigan, but Wisconsin, for example, didn't take video. Lots of places in Arizona didn't take video. There are places in Georgia that didn't take video. We're fighting to get video out of Philadelphia. So the truth of it is, we have a lot of video, 4 million minutes, but we should have 20 million minutes of video. So a lot of these places use the pretext of COVID to not do things that the election rules call on them to do.
Yeah, I mean, the pretext of COVID, of course, was kind of the elephant in the room of all elephants that underlaid all of the shenanigans that went through in this entire election. I mean, you know, from my perspective as a law guy by training, I mean, the way that they were changing the mail-in balloting rules was just flagrantly unconstitutional in various states, in Pennsylvania and North Carolina, just changing it unilaterally through executive fiat, not through the legislature, like Article 2 of the Constitution so clearly commands. But let's stay in the documentary, obviously, for now. So walk us through the math a little bit, because the documentary, there's a lot of numbers in there. I mean, you have real numbers for mules. So I guess I'll start with that, is what is a mule in your nomenclature? And from there, just kind of walk us through the mules to the ballot harvesting to the votes that the film claims should have gone the other direction if it were valid.
Right. So a mule is, I mean, the term is kind of lifted from drug trafficking or sex trafficking, except here we're talking about ballot trafficking. A mule is a paid operative that is hired, in our case, by a left-wing organization to deliver fraudulent and illegal votes to a mail-in drop box. So that's what a mule is. The mule is the middleman. The mule doesn't come up with ballots. The mule goes to a left-wing organization, is handed a satchel or a backpack full of ballots, and then they go kind of on a route from one drop box to another, to another, to another. This is how they get geo-tracked. Now, you may have to ask, and it's worth asking, why go to all these drop boxes? Why not save yourself a whole bunch of time, go to one drop box and drop in 500 ballots? Well, the answer is, the next morning, the election worker would come and open that drop box and notice a massive surge in ballots in that one drop box, which would raise suspicion. So the mules are instructed, don't do that. Three ballots over here, five over there, 10 over here, strew them around, spread them around. And this way, nothing will show up in the custody documents, which are recorded the following day, that will cause a problem. So this is why the mules go from drop box to drop box. But because they do that, they can be geo-tracked. By geo-tracking, of course, we mean we're measuring the movements of their cell phone. So what True the Vote did is they set a very high bar. And the high bar is you have to count as a mule for their tracking, you have to go to 10 or more drop boxes. So if you go to 6 drop boxes, they won't count you. We're only looking for the most egregious mules, the most industrious mules, you might say. And using that criterion, you have to go to left-wing organizations and you have to go to 10 plus drop boxes. We found in 5 states, or actually in the urban areas of 5 states, more than 2,000 mules. The actual number of mules is vastly greater, but 2,000 mules became the title of the movie because the initial search, 10 plus drop boxes, yielded a harvest of 2,000 mules.
Now, if I recall the numbers correctly, it really seemed like ground zero of this entire sprawling operation was in Philadelphia. If I recall, that was by far the highest number of mules. Pennsylvania, obviously, back in 2016, was one of those blue wall states that Donald Trump was able to break through. So tell us a little bit about Pennsylvania and the city of Philadelphia in particular and what you uncovered there.
Sure. So if you look at Pennsylvania, the number of mules is very large. And again, going to 10 or more drop boxes, 1,100 mules. To give you an idea of how big that is, that's five times or four times the number of mules in the Atlanta area. Arizona, about 200 mules. So 1,100 is the big number, the biggest of the five states. These mules were also unbelievably active. They went to an average of 50 drop boxes each, 50 drop box visits each. So you just do the math. Let's multiply, let's say 1,000 by 50. That's 50,000 Dropbox visits. The average number of votes that goes into a Dropbox at a time is five. So that's 250,000, just right off the top of my head, kind of basic math, illegal votes. Now notice that that's just considerably bigger than the margin between Trump and Biden in that state, which was under 100,000 votes. So right away, you see that the volume of fraud is more than enough to have moved Pennsylvania. If you just subtract the fraud of the 2,000 mules, the actual fraud is much bigger, and I can give you an estimate of that. But the simple truth of it is, going by only the 2,000 mules, we have enough fraud to move Pennsylvania from the Biden column back into the Trump column.
So one other obvious question, you know, after watching the film and hearing you explain this again just now, where were our people? Like, where was our side while all of this was going on? And, you know, sunlight's the best disinfectant. There's been so much great exposure from True the Vote, from your film afterwards. How were we so paralyzed in the months leading up to this, and I guess really on election day itself, to not stop this?
The reason is this. The Republican Party had its hands tied by a consent decree that actually goes back almost 40 years. The Republicans stupidly entered into a consent decree that essentially almost took the RNC out of the election monitoring business. Now, this consent decree expired a few years ago, but suffice to say that the Democrats have assembled a crack legal team. I mean, we're talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of lawyers. This is something that they specialize in. This is how they were able to change all these rules. And the Republicans were not able to fight them. Now, when you have an election, you have a very narrow window in which you can legally challenge the outcome. I mean, if you read the Constitution, once the electors meet, they vote, then both houses of Congress sort of ratify. End of story. Then it's on to the inauguration. So if you don't meet that window, and it's almost like saying that, you know, there's going to be a horrible crime going on, but you have to catch the rapist in 60 days. Because if you don't, you can come up with DNA evidence later. We sort of have the DNA evidence now, but and that'll help you to know what happened. He did it. But in a sense, the statute of limitations will have expired and you will have a hard time doing anything legally about it. So what happened with the Republicans is that they suspected a fraud. Trump even predicted a fraud, but they were not smart enough to catch the fraud while it was happening. As a result, all they could do is clumsily try to erect procedural objections. Our observers were not allowed to be close enough. And this has been really my frustration with the debate, because everything from the Trump lawsuits all the way through Molly Hemingway's book, I mean, Molly did a really good job in showing that, you know, here's a bank. And what the Democrats have done is they figured out a way to call the security guards off, at least at night, turn off the surveillance cameras, tell the tellers not to be too rigorous about checking signatures, you know, just look for a scrawl. If it's kind of a scrawl in the same direction, kind of go with it. Now, all of this shows that it's going to make that bank vulnerable to a heist. But what it does not show is whether a heist in fact took place. I think this is really what makes this movie, where the movie takes off, is the movie comes in and shows not only that the playing field was unleveled, that there was the opportunity to do a heist, but that the Democrats actually did one.
So let's head to a quick break. We'll pick this up right on the other side with Dinesh D'Souza. He is the director of the new film, 2000 Mules. Check it out at 2000mules.com. Download it whenever you can. But we'll be right back on the other side. So, Dinesh, the obvious question, just picking back up right where we left off, is how do we fix this for the next time? Are people actually working on this? True the Vote, you know, you've mentioned them. They play a large size in the film. They're obviously doing great work. But I guess from my vantage point, I'm not really seeing kind of the institutional apparatus, the momentum, even the talking points. I mean, the Republican Party leadership obviously is very scared of this issue. They don't talk about it very much. We've seen some progress in the states, obviously. But even when the state of Georgia, for instance, passed a fairly moderate law a little over a year ago now, the left, you know, in coordination with the mainstream media and the corporate press, were able to tar and feather it as Jim Crow 2.0, even though that talking point is farcical beyond belief and an insult to the legacy of Jim Crow and those who suffered under that horrific regime. But how do we fix this for next time? That's the million-dollar question here, obviously.
So I think the first step is that the Republican establishment needs to not only see the film, but grapple with it. There's a guy on social media who was saying, you know, I've been calling all of them. They're like, they don't even know about this movie. They're like, what do we need to see? So the first thing is to get the message out. Remember that this is a movie I'm releasing in an age of censorship. And that means I can't put the trailer on YouTube. I can't put it on Facebook. I've had to devise a whole new business plan for releasing the film. All my earlier films, you can find them on Amazon Prime, Apple, iTunes, but not this time. It's only on uncancelable platforms. So since the movie is just out, I'm not going to be hard on the GOP. My point is, let's give him some time to take a look at it. I'd love to have Ted Cruz see it, and obviously Lindsey Graham, Kevin McCarthy. And so once these guys see it, I think they'll realize that, look, we're not talking here about, you know, affidavits, Mr. X says this and Mrs. Y says that. I'm going to take you to the scene of the crime. You can actually see the mules. And when you see the mules, you realize the absurdity of the so-called fact checkers who say things like, well, maybe it's a cab driver going back and forth, or maybe it's an election worker. I'm like, an election worker? You're seeing a guy in a hoodie in the middle of the night looking to the left and right so as not to be seen, wearing gloves so as not to leave fingerprints on the ballots, taking photos of the ballots going in so as to get paid. This is not someone who is opening up a ballot box and extracting ballots and then writing down the number on a custody document. This is someone secretively and furtively dumping ballots one after the other in a Dropbox and then going on to the next one. So I think when you see the movie, it blows away a lot of the criticisms about it. And I think when the GOP leadership sees this, I hope they realize, listen, this is a problem that involves the existential future of the Republican Party. And there are plenty of ways to fix the problem. I mean, I would start with something really simple. Simply require that all surveillance all Dropboxes have 24-hour surveillance. Right away, it's going to make the mule's job a lot more difficult because, and maybe even put the surveillance online. Somebody somewhere is going to be watching that Dropbox. So you could stop this operation cold with that single step, which there's no excuse not to take.
No, there really is no excuse whatsoever there. But another question that I was thinking about on the way back from the premiere last week, and I've discussed this a little bit as well with John Eastman, who I've been friends with for a while now through the Claremont Institute and all of those good folks. And I've talked about this with John a little bit. I would love your thoughts on this as well, especially given just the visceral impact of the footage that the film now demonstrably shows. I mean, to anyone who is not literally turning a blind eye to the screen right in front of them, where are our receipts? It seems to me that we have not had a single successful prosecution anywhere, right? I mean, no district attorney has been able to kind of go in there. And I understand, look, I'm a lawyer by training. I understand that the resources required for something of this nature obviously would be tremendous. They probably would not tip the outcome, obviously, from some district attorney deep in an urban enclave anywhere. But surely some conservative-leaning, resourceful DA who wants to get on Tucker Carlson or something should take it upon him or herself to start pushing some case, right, somewhere?
Yeah, so this research was done in only five areas: Atlanta, Phoenix, Milwaukee, Detroit, and Philadelphia. If you look at the political configuration, you do have GOP legislatures in really most of those states. On the other hand, the Secretary of State and the Attorney General, by and large, are Democrats, but with a couple of exceptions. Obviously, you have Mark Brnovich, the Attorney General in Arizona. This is a guy who absolutely can do things. And I won't say he's done nothing. He actually has initiated some prosecutions in Yuma, Arizona. In fact, there's a mule interviewed in the movie. She was busted in one of these prosecutions and she cooperated with the authorities. That's how we can get her to talk in the movie, because in a sense, her legal issue has been resolved. There's, of course, Brian Kemp and Raffensperger, the Secretary of State in Georgia. Now, what's complicated there is Raffensperger has opened up an investigation into ballot trafficking in direct response to the data, the geospatial data supplied to him by True the Vote. The problem is, this is the same guy who said the Georgia election was secure. He's like, nothing happened under my watch. He's the guy who got in the verbal spat with Trump. The media lionized him as a kind of champion of fighting against Trump. So it's difficult for him to now say, basically, I was the sheriff. A massive heist was going on right under my nose. I was too dumb to be able to catch it. You know, so all of this is the politics playing out. But I think if enough people put pressure on these guys, something is going to be done. By the way, there's a very simple task to be done now prosecutorially, and that is quite simply unmask the mules. True the Vote, by the way, has the ID, the cell phone IDs of all the mules. They're happy to provide it to law enforcement. That's the first step. Find out their names, go to these guys, who paid you, who put you up to it, who organized this. Because when you're talking about a virtually identical operation in five separate states, obviously this is coordinated.
And who do you think it was coordinated by? I mean, obviously, we're getting into the realm of speculation here, but you've done more of the work here than anyone else. So do you have thoughts on that question?
Yeah, of course I do. I think that this is the way that the Democrats have figured out how to move these operations is they work in coordination without conspiracy. Think, for example, about the Hunter Biden story, to just illustrate my point. It's obviously true that the media didn't all get on a single Zoom call like at 9 a.m. every morning and all decide together, listen, let's suppress this. Let's not say a word about this. That didn't happen. So how is it possible for thousands of journalists who don't talk to each other, nevertheless, to suppress the Hunter Biden story? Well, the answer is they're kind of all on the same side. And so they can coordinate with each other, even if they aren't talking to each other. So similarly here, Mark Zuckerberg, who may know nothing about the mules, I'm not suggesting he does, nevertheless puts private money in a big number, right, almost $500 million, into funding these privately funded drop boxes. Without those drop boxes, the mules have no destination. They have no place to go to. Stacey Abrams, Mark Elias, these are people fighting lawsuits to basically make sure that there isn't rigorous signature matching, there isn't strong voter ID. They attack all of these things as voter suppression. So all these things are going on. So different parts of the left are coordinating together to make it easy to cheat. The actual cheating is being carried out by the nonprofits. By the way, I'm laughing because the nonprofits are forbidden by the IRS to engage in partisan electioneering at all for any party or candidate. But apparently this is where the mules are getting their big stashes of votes. Catherine Engelbrecht of True the Vote calls them vote stash houses. This is where law enforcement needs to go. I don't think this operation is that difficult to bust, but somebody needs to bust it.
So if Republicans retake the House and the Senate this fall, which current polling indicates they are more likely than not to do, they're going to face 2 years with a hostile Democratic White House. So they're not really going to be able to pass a whole lot of legislation, but it seems to me that they should be using their subpoena power liberally to investigate the crap, basically, out of everything that you're talking about here. Have you already, out of curiosity, kind of been in discussion with some folks in the party or in the movement about kind of using the congressional subpoena power to try to shine some spotlight on all of this?
Well, I think that that is an excellent next step. And it's something that I will probably play a role in, but a modest role, because I don't want to try to be, you know, filmmaker and political organizer at the same time. Our goal is to tell the truth and put the story out there. And then True the Vote will pick up what can citizens do in terms of activism. And, you know, we're counting on Republicans to see this. And so the best way for this to happen is for the ordinary guy to contact your representative, to contact your public officials and demand this of them. And then, of course, I think it will happen.
Right. No, totally. That makes sense to me as well. Dinesh, I'm curious about the big tech aspect of this film. I mean, what kind of censorship have you dealt with, out of curiosity? Because this really, like I said earlier on the podcast, this really is a third rail issue. I mean, the number of videos from YouTube that have been yanked, the number of tweets that have been censored, the number of users that have just been fully banned or deplatformed simply for raising the kind of questions that you raise, it's a very, very, very high number, obviously. So I'm curious what kind of specific pushback from the tech platforms you've already received.
Well, I mean, number one, this is the most censored topic in the country, right? There's censorship on the trans issue, on abortion, on climate change, on COVID, but nowhere is the censorship more systematic, more intense than on this issue. And think of the irony. I mean, we're releasing videos that are showing criminal corrupt activity, and we're using the official surveillance video of the states themselves. I mean, this is not Project Veritas. No one's giving me this in the middle of the night. This is not some guy in his truck turning on his iPhone. This is the official video of the state of Georgia. I don't even have to give it to them. They already have it. They took it, right? And yet, if I put it on YouTube, they're going to censor it. They're going to censor it not because it's disinformation. It's clearly not. They're going to censor it because it's information. They're going to censor it because it's true. And so this is the very surreal situation that we're in which truth itself is being suppressed in the name of, quote, fighting disinformation. So bottom line of it is I've had to figure out ways to release this movie in manner that cannot be taken down. This is why I'm so thrilled to have the high-tech video platform Rumble behind me. Rumble sees in it, not only, they see in it a business opportunity. And so what they've said is, listen, Dinesh, you know, you be the content creator, we'll promote this movie. Essentially, you can prove that you can release a film and make it successful without going to Netflix, without going to Amazon Prime, and we're proving it to be the case.
Why is this the most censored topic in the entire country? I mean, I guess the obvious answer is because it's literally their guy, Joe Biden, whose legitimacy is in doubt. Is that the answer from your perspective?
I think it's the answer because of this. There's the widespread belief that there was systematic cheating, but no one could sort of vindicate that, right? No one could sort of really prove it. And people tried, right? I mean, I watched, you know, Mike Lindell's movie and I looked at it and I was like, well, I see Mike Lindell, he's telling me the Chinese are hacking the election, but I mean, I don't see any Chinese. You know, I don't know. I'm not a cyber guy. So it takes a kind of cyber expertise to even evaluate that kind of evidence. The beauty of our movie is that you don't need any of that. You just watch it with an open mind and keep your eyes open and you're going to see the crimes being committed in front of your eyes. So the truth of it is that the censorship is just downright awful. But the reason they're so scared of this issue is they don't want to prove those suspicions right. I mean, think about it. The guys who went to D.C. on January 6th, did they go to mount an insurrection? Oh, yeah, we're little Robert E. Lee's. No. I mean, they went there because they were like, you know, somebody cheated in this election big time and no one's even adjudicating it. No one's even looking at it. So it was, I put it in the movie, a primal scream on the part of people. Listen, we just want you to take a look at this. And here we come, you know, a year and a half later. And in a sense, what we're saying is that although those guys shouldn't have gone into the Capitol, of course, nevertheless, their suspicion, their instinct, their motivation for going to DC, they were right.
How much of the right of center reluctance to broach this topic or speak up about it at all, really, do you think is attributable to the fact that large swaths of the right of center establishment in America simply never reconciled themselves to President Trump to begin with? Is that a large part of what's going on here, you think?
Yes, I think that is a large part of what's going on here. I also think that the establishment right essentially has a general belief in the integrity and validity of institutions. And I say this because I did too. I mean, I'm a creature of the Reagan era. We believed in law enforcement. If you told me, you know, 20 years ago that the FBI had been rotted at the core and that these guys were, you know, framing people and said, you know, if I go back to the Bush years, I remember reading some accusations, the FBI framed some Syrian guys and, you know, said that they were in ISIS, even though the FBI sort of put them up to it. And I just dismissed all that as nonsense. Why would the FBI even do that? But today, if you ask me the same thing, when I look back, I'm like, well, you know, I'm going to have to look at the evidence. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. So the point is, I think what's happened is that on a large part of the right, there is an understanding that even institutions that we automatically believed in, the CDC, obviously they're just giving you health information, the FBI, obviously they're just going after the bad guys. The establishment right still believes those things, which I think are now complete nonsense. But nevertheless, the establishment right has a vested belief in that. The military, yeah, if they say that there's an expedition that needs to be conducted, obviously they've evaluated situation objectively, they're patriots. No, not necessarily. So we're seeing a crisis of institutions, and a large part of the right now sees these institutions as somehow being either rotted or taken over by the bad guys, whereas the establishment GOP still thinks that everything over here is by and large just fine.
So let's end on this. So there's so much, obviously, in the way of ballot harvesting and the mail-in balloting that has resulted in fraud, the likes of which we probably have never seen in American history. But well before any of this, I mean, I think back to when I was in law school. I remember getting in debates with classmates about early voting. I mean, the notion of early voting has always struck me as fundamentally incompatible with the very notion of voting in representative democracy. I mean, a vote is supposed to be a snapshot in time, not a moving target, right? I think about the Hunter Biden laptop story at the New York Post and how roughly 15 to 20% of people who voted for Biden, according to polls, say that they would have changed their vote had that information been publicly available and not brutally suppressed by the big tech oligarchs. So, final question, Dinesh, what is the ideal solution here as far as what election day and the election process every 4 years looks like?
Well, I mean, I agree completely that the best solution is a single election day, and ideally you vote in person. Now, the notion of voting by absentee ballot crept in as a sort of exception. You know, what if you're confined in a facility, but you nevertheless are mentally competent? So, but the absentee ballots have been known to be the largest venue of fraud for the simple reason that the absentee ballot, that whole process is conducted outside of any supervision. It's completely different than when you walk into a polling place, you go behind the curtain, there's nobody with you, there's nobody cajoling you or slipping you a $20 bill. But I mean, think about it. If I were to go to a polling place, get my ballot and say, hey, listen, guys, I need to go home for 2 hours and do some things. I'll come back and bring out the ballot filled out. Nobody would let me do that. Why not? Because the custody of that ballot is then corrupted. Well, think about it. That is what happens with absentee and mail-in ballots. And we've allowed absentee and mail-in ballots under the pretext of COVID to become, in a sense, almost the largest way that people now cast a ballot. So yes, I think that we have seen a real distortion of the integrity of the election process. Now, not all of that toothpaste can be put back in the tube. I don't see a repeal of some forms of early voting. That's likely to continue. I even see some of these ballot drop boxes still going on. So I think we need to have a principal position, but we also need to realize that there are places where some of this stuff is going to go on. And the best we can do there is make sure that the integrity of those processes are also carefully monitored and supervised the best we can.
Dinesh D'Souza, thanks so much for joining this week.
My pleasure.
If I recall the post-2020 data, something approximating 40% of the populace thinks that there was large-scale fraud that occurred in the 2020 election. And again, the point here is that even if you don't necessarily accept every single little argument, if you care about the health of the republic, if you care about the basic idea that everyone needs to have their fair shot, that their vote has to count, and that we, the people, as the preamble of the Constitution says, are sovereigns, that we, the people, control our own destiny, that is totally not possible. It is totally facially, absurdly impossible if such a large percentage of the people feel like their votes are being deprived. That is a very, very, very simple, straightforward argument. So if you understand that perspective, and I think, again, you should be able to readily intuit that, the question then is, shouldn't you take very, very mild pro-integrity, pro-security measures to better salvage this, quote, more perfect union, again, of which the preamble speaks, so that we can pass it on to the next generation. But I want to also, in this final segment here, kind of talk a little bit about what Dinesh and I were getting at in one of those final questions there, which is the idea of an election as a snapshot in time. So again, well before there was the proliferation of mail-in balloting, well before there was the COVID era and states were trying to willy-nilly unilaterally change their election rules via executive fiat and things of that, well before that, for really decades now, there has been at least some idea of early voting across the states. And voting in our constitutional structure is a state issue, so the states get to control it with the exception of the various constitutional amendments, like the 15th Amendment and so forth, that require federal regulations for voting. And in any event, early voting has really proliferated and become pretty predominant over the past few decades. But it fundamentally misunderstands the idea of an election. Think about what happened in the 2016 election. Let's steer it away from 2020. And we just talked about the Hunter Biden laptop story and how 15 to 20% of Biden voters themselves, according to public polling, according to legitimate public polling, do say they would have voted otherwise if they had known about the level of Biden family corruption that was shown in the hard drive of the laptop. But go back to 2016. Think about the, you know, if you're a Democrat, think about the Billy Bush video, right? Think about the Billy Bush video that came out in early October, you know, with, you know, then Donald Trump wasn't president yet, talking about grabbing by the you know what, and we know what we're talking about there. Think about if you were a Hillary Clinton voter, right? Wouldn't you have wanted everyone to be able to vote based on that information? Think about that. If you are a Hillary Clinton voter, and if you are a Democrat, wouldn't you not have wanted Trump voters to be able to early vote? Wouldn't you want them to maybe change their mind based on that? But these bombshells always happen on the precipice of an election because that's just the nature of a bombshell. People try to wait for the last moment because most people still do vote on election day. But at the end of the day, I think what Dinesh said, the idea here has to be ultimately a constitutional amendment to define election day. Let's call it a national holiday, give people off work, and that's it. There's no early voting. You can vote absentee if you are active duty military, if you are elderly, confined to a hospital, things like that. But the default rule has to be a single national day for voting. I think Republicans desperately need to start speaking about this as a proposed constitutional amendment, and please do it yesterday. But on that note, thanks for listening. I'm Josh Hammer. See you next time.